This is Rabbi Josh Yoder of the Stanton Street Shul. Thank you for downloading this class podcast. These classes are provided free of charge through the generosity of the Stanton Street Shul community and supporters like you. If you do enjoy them, please consider making a donation to our synagogue's building fund on our website's shop donate page at www.stantonstshul.com.
Good morning. It is Sunday, January 26th, 2014. Thank you all for coming out in this really freezing weather. My phone tells me it's 18 degrees. I know wind chill feels like it's 15. It's cold. So thank you for coming out. Want to move on to chapter 6 because I was looking through the rest of chapter 5. There's not much else in there in the rest of the chapter that's really relevant. We were talking about lighting Shabbat candles. One part at the end we can just summarize, which is Rambam talks about a practice that goes back to the rabbinic times of before Shabbat, on every Friday, they would blow the shofar as sort of a warning that Shabbat is coming. For obvious reasons, we don't do that anymore here. Not only would it be crazy confusing, but like no one's going to notice. You're in New York, for God's sake. I mean, it's noise all the time. But if you're in Israel, in some communities, you will actually hear various, I don't want to say announcements. When I was in Beit Vegan, there was a certain time before Shabbat, they would play a song, and then there would be a siren, like before Shabbat. So not quite exactly the shofar, but you can see like why, you know, they would still do it, or at least in a place like Israel, like, hey, this is a warning. And why in the time of the Gemara, where you didn't have people checking their watches, you didn't have alarms. Remember, you know, you're trying to determine what time of day it is by the sun. So you'd have someone who's like, in church, like, yo, blow the shofar. It's like, it's time to get ready. And like, you'd have like intermittent things. So that would be a nice warning. It's like, hey, we got to stop what we're doing and get ready for Shabbos. Right? So that's what Rambam talks about in the last part of the chapter. We don't need to spend so much time with those details. Know that he says it. Know if you go to Israel, you'll hear it. I guess that's, you know, the origins of why they do it. And though it's not exact, but consider it a nice little experience there. Moving on to chapter 6. This is still part of the components where Rambam's talking about the prep for Shabbat in terms of arrangements that you make beforehand. And this gets into issues that come up a lot in terms of practical questions I get. The subject of, in Hebrew, called Amira La'akum or Amira La'nachri, the rules of telling a non-Jew to do work for you on Shabbat, or to what extent can a non-Jew do work for you on Shabbat. This comes up in a whole lot of different scenarios. So, start us off, Sam. This is chapter 6, halacha 1.
It is forbidden for us to tell a Gentile to perform work on Shabbat on our behalf, although they are not commanded to observe Shabbat. This applies even when the instructions were conveyed to them before Shabbat, and we do not require the products of their work until after Shabbat. The above is forbidden as a rabbinical prohibition to prevent the people from regarding Shabbat lightly, lest they perform forbidden labor themselves.
All right, so stop here for a second. This is the general rule, and like we've said before with Rambam, when he starts a chapter, he starts very general, and then he gradually gets into the specifics. So the basic rule is, you're not allowed to have a non-Jew do work for you on Shabbat. He says here, even if it doesn't get directly, even if you tell it beforehand and you don't need it afterwards. And the reason is, it's a rabbinic decree, lest you come to take Shabbat lightly and do it yourself. Okay, so that is a concern. There's a footnote here that there's another reason that's given for it, is that you shouldn't talk about mundane matters on Shabbat. But let's set aside the reason for the law, because at least according to the opinion of Rambam, his halachic approach, the reason for the law is irrelevant when it comes to practical legal decision making. He'll include it in terms of giving you a reason for it, but as we discuss in the halachic process class, the way that the Rambam views Jewish law, even if the reason is not applicable, the law is still in effect. Right? But it's important to realize this isn't a biblical prohibition. It's a rabbinic prohibition not to have non-Jews do work for you on Shabbat. All right? Mike, take the next one.
The following rules apply when a Gentile performs a forbidden labor on Shabbat on his own accord. If he's performed it on behalf of a Jew, he's forbidden to benefit from that labor until waiting the amount of time necessary to perform the labor on Saturday night. The latter leniency is granted, provided the matter is not public notice, i.e. everyone knows that a particular task is being performed for a person on Shabbat. If the Gentile performed the labor for his own sake alone, it is permitted to benefit from it on Shabbat.
Okay. So a few things here. One, let's say he did it, right? You're not allowed to benefit from it until you wait the time, Kadesha Te'aseh. You remember that idiom? You wait the time that it would have taken him to do it. You remember why?
Yeah, so that way you use you honor the whole period of the Sabbath.
Kind of, because you're not taking direct benefit from his labor. Because once you wait that certain amount of time after Shabbat, then you didn't benefit from him working on Shabbat. Because any time gain that you might have, you know, gained from him doing it, you've lost, right? So that's fine. He also throws in a distinction here about provided is that it is not known publicly that he's doing this for Shabbat. So he explains in a little bit more detail. Next one.
What is implied? If a Gentile kindled a candle for his own benefit, the Jew is also permitted to perform activity by its light. If the Gentile kindled the light on behalf of the Jew, it is forbidden. Similarly, if a Gentile made a ramp to descend from a ship himself, a Jew may descend after him. If he made it for the Jew, it is forbidden. If he filled a trench with water to allow his animal to drink, a Jew may have his own animal drink afterwards. If he did it for the sake of the Jew, it is forbidden. If a Gentile gathered grass to feed his animal, a Jew may bring his animal to eat from it, provided that the Gentile does not know the Jew. If he does, it is forbidden, lest he bring more on his behalf, at which point he would be performing a forbidden labor on behalf of a Jew. Similarly, whenever there is a possibility that the Gentile will add more on a Jew's behalf, a Jew should not benefit unless the Gentile does not know the Jew.
All right, so here, you're talking about he's trying, how to put this, if the non-Jew does it for himself, that's fine. Once he does it specifically for a Jew, and it's known that it's for a Jew, that's a problem. All right? So there seems to be not just a matter of him doing the work, but also that it be known that it is doing specifically for the Jew. And here's an interesting contrast. In contrast, when a matter concerns a situation where there is no concept of increasing or decreasing one's effort for the sake of the Jew, meaning for a light or a ramp, since the Gentile performed these activities for his own sake, a Jew may benefit from them afterwards on the Sabbath, even when the Gentile knows them. The following laws apply when a lamp is kindled at a gathering of Jews and Gentiles on Shabbat. If most of the people in attendance are Jewish, it is forbidden to benefit from the light, since the one who kindles it do so for the sake of the majority. If the majority are Gentiles, it is permitted to benefit from the light, even if the proportions are equal. If the proportions are equal, it is forbidden. If a fire broke out on Shabbat and a Gentile comes to extinguish it, we may not tell him extinguish it, nor must we tell him do not extinguish it, for his resting is not our responsibility. The same applies in all similar situations. All right, so let's explain. These things have to go together. So one, there are some actions where if a non-Jew does, he benefits equally with the Jew. So example would be turning on lights in a room. Right? There's no additional act of turning on lights of a room for the Jews. I mean, unless maybe you can somehow construct a case where the Jews are only in one corner of the room and he specifically turns on that one for the Jews, but that's an exceptional case. For most things that, you know, we're talking about here is, non-Jew does it just as he'd do the same for himself anyway, fine. If, however, it requires doing additional specific malacha, doing another prohibited act specifically for a Jew, that would be problematic. Now, let's say there's a mixture. You go by the rove. You go by the majority. If the majority of people would be Jewish, problem. Majority of people not Jewish, no problem. Right? And if it's equal, Maimonides here is, you know, goes strict. Although, that gets a little bit difficult to explain because 50-50, there's a debate in the Talmud whether or not 50-50 counts as a majority because it's straight down the middle. It's kind of unresolved, and this is doubtful, but whatever. Yeah.
This is maybe nitpicking, but just...
There's no nitpicking in halacha. That's pretty much all of halacha, so like, don't complain about that. Yeah.
If the proportions are equal, it is forbidden, but if you have a group of two, the proportions are equal, and like you're allowed to... benefit. So
that would be if he does it specifically for him, because then I guess, yeah, how exactly do you do the counting? Whether or not the non-Jew himself is counted among the people who benefit is a wonderful question. If you're talking about a large crowd, I don't think anyone's going to sit and count.
Right.
You know, the other thing here at the end...
What if it's a small crowd? What if it's like eight people and then four Gentiles and four Jews?
Yeah, and then where does the non-Jew who flips the light, where does he fall into that? Does he, you know, count for one? Does he count for the other? You could say that if he does it specifically for... Yeah, that is a very good question here. According to... Let's say according to Maimonides, the proportions are equal, it's forbidden. Yeah, I mean, you know,
is there a certain point where it flips over, like four is okay, but eight is not?
Yeah, I honestly don't know how to like parse out that math there.
What if the non-Jew doesn't know how many Jews and non-Jews? What if it's a big crowd and we're talking about?
So that goes back to him not knowing it. So once he's not really aware of it, then it would seem to be okay. Like if very few people do like Jew checks,
right.
Like just to make sure it's like, oh, you're Jewish, you're not Jewish. Then it would seem to be okay. And then this last one. You know, if the guy is going to do it on his own, right? I mean, there's a difference also between, you know, asking him to do it and him doing it on his own. So, like, let's say there's a fire, right?
Yeah.
Now, the fire department comes in. Let's assume, like, your fire department's, you know, run mostly by non-Jews. You don't tell them, no, don't put out the fire, right? You might not be able to call them. I mean, again, pikuach nefesh is a whole separate issue. You know, take that out of the equation. Let's say it's a non-life-threatening fire, right? But if they come by and try to put it out, you don't actively stop them either, okay?
Right.
More details here. The following principles apply when Gentiles make a coffin, dig a grave, or bring flutes to play mourning dirges on behalf of a deceased person. If this was done discreetly, one must wait until the activity could have been carried out on Saturday night, and then the person may be buried using the above. If, however, the grave was located in a public square and the coffin placed upon it, and all those who pass by say, this activity that the Gentiles are performing on the Sabbath is for the sake of so-and-so, that a Jew may never be buried using the above, for this is a matter of public knowledge. Another Jew, however, may be buried using the above, provided that the people wait the amount of time necessary for these activities to have been performed after the Sabbath concluded. The same applies in all similar situations. So this sort of like narrows it down a little bit further. In terms of the public knowledge, Maimonides includes here, if you know that this is done specifically for this specific Jew, then that specific Jew would not be able to take benefit from it. But if it's done, let's say for a specific Jew, then someone else might be able to take benefit from it. Now, you mentioned earlier about nitpicking, this seems like splitting hairs, right? But when you consider that this is a rabbinic decree, let's even assuming like the Maimonides, like the reason Maimonides gave, you don't want to treat Shabbat lightly. Because think about it, if you have, you know, non-Jews doing the work for you on Shabbat, it's very easy to bypass a whole lot of things. So you're not getting, the person for whom he's violating Shabbat is not getting direct benefit, right? That is, seems to be the main concern. Because once you do gain direct benefit, well then, you know, the entire walls come, you know, can come down. All right, make a little more sense here about why the public knowledge is necessary. If anyone is interested here, this is actually someone from, I didn't bring it this week, I'll try to bring it next week. I actually have a wonderful book written by a guy named Jacob Katz, who is one of the preeminent scholars in the history and evolution of Jewish law and practice, where he would trace down like how certain things would work. He's a remarkable writer. And he has a book that's actually called, quote, The Shabbos Goy, subtitled Case Study in Halachic Flexibility. You might know of the idiom, the Shabbos Goy. That would be the specific non-Jew. You know, arrange certain things to have stuff done for you. So this stuff was, like, well-known for a long time. And there were some very creative mechanisms that people used to, in fact, get certain things done on Shabbat and how they worked around a lot of these halachot. So you should know there's a wonderful book on this that, again, gives you some very interesting opinions beyond just what Maimonides has. I'll bring it in next week, if hopefully I remember. I believe Colin Powell was one of them. That's why he knew Yiddish.
Oh, really? Interesting.
Yeah, I could be wrong on that, but that's that's my recollection, that he knew Yiddish because he was a Shabbos goy when he was growing up. So he learned a lot of this stuff here. But... And we'll get to a few of those details, you know, later on here. But yeah, the concern is, if it's publicly known that a non-Jew did work for a specific Jew on Shabbat, that gets to be problematic. Now you could say, well, what does it matter whether or not it's publicly known or not? Well, what do you think? What does it matter if everyone knows that this was done as opposed to private?
because they may not know the nuances and they may not do any kind of work.
Well, you may not know the nuances, and if this is a rabbinic decree, lest Shabbat be started to treat lightly, right? If something does get out to public, then more people are going to start treating it lightly, right? Or, I mean, following this approach, like taking the other opinion of you don't want to discuss mundane matters, I'm not sure how being public or private might matter in terms of all these decrees, but at least you can, you know, following the first approach, you don't want Shabbat to be taken lightly. Once it does get out as public, well, this guy can do it. Well, everyone can do it. And then, again, the entire system falls apart. Okay? Who are we up to?
But what would be the benefit that a Jew would get out of a Gentile having a funeral?
It's not a Gentile having a funeral. Grave diggers. Right? Gentile digs a grave on Shabbat, right? It's publicly known that he's doing it for this specific Jew on Shabbat. Yeah. I've never, thank God, had to dig a grave, but I can understand why someone wouldn't want to and why it's labor intensive, right? So if it's a public figure in a public square, that's one thing. Otherwise, if it's done kind of more in private, something else, right? Continue, I think we're up to you, Sam. Number six.
The following rules apply when a Gentile brings flutes on Shabbat to mourn a deceased person. Even though he brought them from outside the wall, we are required to wait the time it takes to bring them from a closed place after Shabbat is concluded, and afterwards we may mourn with them. This restriction stems from our suspicion that he brought them from another place at night and then entered with them in the morning. If one is certain that they were brought from another place on Shabbat, one should wait the amount of time until it is possible he bring them from the place after the conclusion of Shabbat. The above leniencies apply only when the flutes were not brought in a public square, as mentioned above.
So this doesn't just apply to the digging purposes, but even carrying. Meaning as long as the actions involved violating a malacha of Shabbat, that's where it kicks in. Right? Because you don't want to take advantage of someone else. You don't want to say desecrating Shabbat because the non-Jew has no obligation to keep Shabbat, but you don't want to take advantage of someone who did something that for you would be prohibited on Shabbat. Now, here's a very important number seven.
The following rules apply with regard to a city inhabited by both Jews and Gentiles that possesses a bathhouse that is open on Shabbat. If the majority of the bathers are Gentiles, it is permitted to bathe in it on Saturday night immediately after the conclusion of Shabbat. If the majority of the bathers are Jewish, one must wait the time it takes for the water to heat. The rationale is that the water was heated for the majority of the city's bathers. If the number of Jews and Gentiles are equal, one must wait the time it takes for the water to heat. The same applies in all similar situations.
Okay. So here again, if it's a majority, you assume that if it's an equal majority, you assume it was done for both. If it's majority of Jews, you got a problem. If the majority are non-Jews, not a problem. This causes, or at least this halacha can cause some very difficult questions, particularly if you live in Israel. Because most of the people who live in Israel, Jews. Right? The city, you know, still keeps running, or at least some basic public services keep running on Saturday, right? Operated by Jews. So what do you do with that? Thankfully, I don't have to answer that question. I'm sure you'll find people who, you know, come up with such answers like how do you run electric, you know, power plants on Shabbat? You know, buses, trains, all that stuff. Like how long do you have to wait and all that? Some places actually like they think shut down like completely until after Shabbat, but they're clearly in just to keep the infrastructure of the country running. Statistically, you're going to have Jews working on Shabbat in order to provide for Jews. All right? I don't believe that they just rent out the entire place and have, you know, Israeli Arabs, working all the plants. To my knowledge, that doesn't happen. So speak to your Israeli friends and your Israeli rabbis how they get around all this.
Even if the water was heated for the Gentiles, don't you still, as a Jew, have to go to the bathhouse and do all these things basically to get the benefit from it? It's not like when you just walk into a room, the light is already on. You had to have the intention to go there specifically to bathe and to get benefit from it.
Right, so we're assuming that the non-Jews are the ones who were operating the bathhouse, but if the majority of people in the town, I mean, let's say, consider a bathhouse a public service, all right, like a public utility.
Right.
If the majority of the people in the town are not Jewish, then you're assuming that when the Gentiles did all this stuff to keep the bathhouse going, they didn't do it for the Jews.
Right.
They did it for the non-Jews. But if the majority of the people there are Jews, then you assume they're keeping the public service open for the Jews because they are the majority.
Right, but it seemed like the other examples are mostly like where you just happen to be in the same place as the Gentile. Where this one, it seems like unless you live at the bathhouse, you would have to physically make the decision to go to the bathhouse and benefit from what the Gentile.
Oh, I see. So you want to determine it by not so much the people living in the town, but the people using the facility.
Right, like the example with the boat and the light, it seems like if you just kind of showed up and there's a light or you happen to be on the same boat as the Gentile, here it seems like you're specifically going to the bathhouse to benefit from what the Gentile's doing on Shabbat.
And according to Rambam, you'd be okay with that if the intent of the non-Jew doing all this stuff was primarily for non-Jews. Because you're not going on Shabbat, you're going after Shabbat. So you're benefiting from the work that a non-Jew did on Shabbat, but to benefit other non-Jews.
I see.
And
so
that you're okay.
After sundown on Saturday.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
But what if you pay a monthly fee for that service, then you're benefiting sort of from what you paid on Shabbat?
Yeah. We'll get to the shutafut. Like, he gets into like business dealings a little bit later in terms of like paying people off for that. Again, or at least for the bathhouse case, pretend it's a public utility. So if it's a public utility, everyone's paying in for it, right? As opposed to something very specific. The counterexample, which you know, we should get to in some details here, about what about a shul janitor, right? Because a janitor of a shul is cleaning up specifically for Jews in a Jewish place, right? That scenario specifically for Jews. A bathhouse, again, as a utility, is for the whole town, so everyone might chip in to pay for it, but as long as the majority of those people chipping in are non-Jews, you know, you're okay. Alright?
Eight.
Up to you. Yeah, number eight.
A Jew who instructs a Gentile to perform a forbidden labor on his behalf on Shabbat commits a transgression and should be given stripes for rebellion as punishment. Nevertheless, he is permitted to benefit from the labor on Saturday night after waiting the time it takes for the labor to have been performed.
So stop here for a second. So let's say you violated this. So technically, you violated a rabbinic prohibition, the Makot Mardut, are translated here stripes or lashes for rebellion, as opposed to like the biblical lashes. So it's basically rabbis keeping you in line. But even if you did that, you could still benefit from it after Shabbat, given that time, differential. Okay, continue.
The following is the sole reason for which the sages forbade using the products of forbidden labor until the time to perform the labor passes on Saturday night. If one permitted the use of the products of forbidden labor immediately on Saturday night, a person might tell a Gentile to perform a forbidden labor on his behalf so that after the conclusion of Shabbat, it will be immediately available for him. Since, however, the products of forbidden labor are forbidden until the time it takes for the labor to have been performed passes, he will not instruct a Gentile to perform this task. It does not bring him any benefit at all, for on Saturday evening, he must wait the time it takes for the labor to have been performed on Shabbat.
Mm-hmm. So here he actually explains what we said before. Number nine, this is a really tricky one. A Jew is permitted to instruct a Gentile to perform an activity that is not a forbidden labor and is prohibited from being performed on the Sabbath only as a Shavuot. This leniency applies provided this is necessary because of a minor infirmity, a very pressing matter, or a mitzvah. Shavuot, as described here, is footnote 37, an activity forbidden by the sages because it resembles a foreign labor or because it might lead to the performance of a forbidden labor, meaning a rabbinic prohibition, not a biblical one. The rationale behind this leniency is the principle that a rabbinic prohibition is not instituted to support another rabbinic prohibition. Ein gozerin gezeira legzeira. Since the activity in question is merely a rabbinic prohibition, and the prohibition against instructing a Gentile to perform a forbidden activity on the Sabbath is rabbinic in origin, the two rabbinic prohibitions should not be associated. Okay? Now, this is a pretty big halacha that the Rambam then qualifies, which I understand more for policy reasons than clear halacha. The simple rule is, we set up, like, remember when we said at the very beginning, we set up a fence around the Torah. The rabbi said, don't do certain things, lest you come to violate biblical law. They didn't say, don't do these things, lest you violate rabbinic law. They don't, like, put a fence around a fence, to use the idiom. So here, since the Amir La'akum, telling a non-Jew to do something, is rabbinically prohibited, but it's only rabbinically prohibited to tell him to do a biblical prohibition. But to tell him to do a rabbinic prohibition should be permissible. Right? Now, Rambam again qualifies it here that you don't just do it willy-nilly. You need to have, like, it's got to be, like, some reason, either a little bit of illness or to fulfill a commandment, or you've got, like, needs of the masses. Right? Now, again, those qualifications, if you're really following Ein Gzeirah al Gzeirah, you don't have a decree on a decree, those qualifications technically shouldn't matter. Additionally, you could even double up Amir al-Akum, meaning, let's say you're a non-Jew, and you're a non-Jew. I can't tell you directly to do something, but I could tell you to tell him to do something. Meaning, have that little game of telephone there. Right? Because Amir La'akum itself is rabbinic. So Amir La'akum for Amir La'akum should be fine. Right? I don't know many people who say that, but the logic is, you know, sound. This is also another reason why it's important to know the difference between what's a biblical prohibition and a rabbinic prohibition, so that when certain things come up, you'll be able to know how to adjust, you know, in certain needs. So if there's a minor, you know, someone's like, you know, just a little bit sick, to tell a non-Jew to do something explicitly that's only rabbinically prohibited is fine. Or, you know, if something happens in a synagogue and you know this is only a rabbinic prohibition, have a non-Jew do it. So a good example would be, let's say you're living in a place where carrying is only a rabbinic prohibition. We haven't gotten to that yet. That comes up later. Right? And you need something brought over for a certain thing, well, then you could ask a non-Jew directly to do it because it's only a rabbinic prohibition of carrying. Right, involved there. And if it's for the needs of the community, sure. Right? Knowing those details is important for this sorts of things. Doubling up on Amir al-Akum, I don't know anyone who actually said that you should do that. Here's an example. 10.
What is implied? On Shabbat, a Jew may instruct a Gentile to climb a tree or to swim across water to bring him a shofar or a knife for circumcision. Similarly, one may instruct a Gentile to bring hot water from one courtyard to another to wash a child or a person experiencing difficulty, although an Eruv was not made to join them. The same applies in all similar situations.
Right, so this is the exception he gives for carrying. Mike, take number 11.
When a person buys a house in Eretz Yisrael from a Gentile, he is permitted to tell the Gentile to compose a deed of sale on Shabbat. Giving the Gentile instructions to perform a forbidden labor on Shabbat is a rabbinic prohibition, and because of the importance of settling Eretz Yisrael, the sages did not enforce their decree in this instance. Similarly, the above principles apply when one purchases a house from a Gentile in Syria, where Syria is equivalent to Eretz Yisrael in this regard.
Yeah, that last part gets a little bit tricky. There's an explanation for that that'll take about an hour to explain. It's a separate question on Eretz Yisrael. But here's a case where even the rabbinic prohibition of Amir La'akum is suspended, not just for the purpose of a mitzvah. Right? Now, this isn't even Amir La'akum for a rabbinic prohibition. Right? Writing on Shabbat is a biblical prohibition. Me telling a non-Jew to write on Shabbat is a rabbinic prohibition, which according to this halacha, I'm allowed to suspend that rabbinic prohibition in order to fulfill the commandment to get a house in Israel, to live in Israel. An important halacha, being people forget, like, living in Israel is a mitzvah. So you could even suspend here. I mean, it's important to realize this, that this example that Maimonides gives is a step above what he said in law number 9. What he said in law number 9 was telling a non-Jew to perform a rabbinic prohibition. Here, it's even telling a non-Jew to perform a biblical prohibition. And in this case, it's okay because you're doing it for the purpose of a mitzvah. The mitzvah of settling the land of Israel. Let's do one more.
Okay. When a person contracts a Gentile for a task and sets the price, the Gentile is considered as acting in his own interests. Therefore,
actually, you know what? Stop here, because this gets into a whole section about matters of commerce. And commerce is a whole separate beast. So let's hold off here. We'll stop with number 11. We'll pick up with 12 next week, because then we get into exchanges and business dealings, which do get a little more complicated. So any questions so far?
Yes.
Please.
Real life questions.
Excellent.
My former boss, who is not Jewish, lives in Grand Street,
okay,
in a building that is mostly Hasidic. And when she gets in the elevator on Saturday, they ask her to press the button.
Uh-huh.
Not allowed.
So that is a wonderful question. What do you think? Based on what we learned.
It's directly for... they asked her to do it, and it's for them.
So remember, what do you think it depends on?
It's whether it's rabbinic or biblical.
Beautiful! Beautiful! Good job, Mike. Yeah.
It's probably allowed, right?
It would depend on whether or not you think pushing the button in the elevator is biblical or rabbinic.
Right.
If you think pushing it violates a biblical prohibition, then you'd have a problem. If you think it's rabbinic or less, you're okay. Now, what does that mean? The halacha, I gave a four-part series on electricity and exactly what comes there. And it's not so explicit what prohibition you might actually be violating there.
It depends on whether or not you think you're creating a fire.
It's really complicated and it gets political because there was a clear desire to have electricity forbidden. People came up with a lot of different possibilities and theories as to why, many of which don't hold up against scrutiny. And sometimes people really got caught. Like, we spent one class comparing two responses of Rabbi Moshe Feinstein, one in which he prohibited microphones and in the second which he permitted hearing aids for mutually exclusive reasons.
Right.
One reason why he said a microphone was no good is you might come to fix it. One reason why he said a hearing aid was fine is because it doesn't always work. So we spent like a full class just going through those in great detail. It's not simple, but you got the halacha exactly correct. If you assume that it's biblical, you violate Shabbat biblically by pushing an elevator button, then yes, it would be prohibited. If you think it's only rabbinic, then you'd be fine, according to Rambam at least.
And what about when Israelis go on vacation for holidays and they stay at...
You're asking the Yom Tov Sheni thing. No, that's not the Yom Tov Sheni thing.
Cooking.
Yeah.
Like, when they go away for the holidays.
Yeah, to America or to...
I don't know. They go to Egypt. They go all over the place.
Yeah.
But on the holiday, when you're not permitted to cook, they're being served.
Yeah, we're going to go through that for the next ones, because that gets into, like, the whole contract thing. How does that work?
Okay.
Not just Israelis, by the way.
Yeah.
Believe it or not, Jews used to go up for resorts.
I was going to say the Catskills.
Uh-huh.
Well, that's what I was really thinking originally.
The Cats, sure. You've got... There are actually some really wonderfully depressing pictures about, like, the Homowack today and, like, Grossinger's and just what a horrid state of disrepair they're in.
Yeah.
And these used to be, like, luxury resorts, but absolutely... again, you've got anyone who does catering for an affair, like a Shabbos bar mitzvah,
right?
You have people that come in and do stuff.
Right.
Happens a whole bunch of times. That's why I wanted to hold off on the next bunch of laws, because those gets into more preset business deals of, like, how do you go about doing these sorts of things? These are fantastic questions. But again, when I think things are going to get too complicated, first, like, get part one down. We'll have more time to do, you know, the others in later parts. But this is why, like, I want to spend more time with this, and why these are some of the biggest questions I get. How do you benefit from paying a guy to do work for you on Shabbat, be it synagogue janitor, be it caterers, going up to a place like the Homowack, or, you know, places where they're actually, like, doing cooking? Well, some places the truth is in kitchens might minimize things, meaning they may do the cooking before Shabbat and just do reheating on Shabbat.
Right.
So that's one simple way of getting around things. I haven't worked... Anyone here work in the hotel industry or, like, as a waiter stuff behind... No? I only ask because it's a common summer job that people, friends of mine have. I can... You know what? I'll try to double check with friends of mine, like, what actually goes on behind the scenes. But of course, I'll wind up with more stories than I can. Yeah. What else?
Another question. Number 11.
Yeah.
Are all mitzvot, like, equal in terms of your ability to ask a non-Jew to do?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. The thing with regarding Eretz Yisrael happens to be mentioned specifically in the Gemara. So that could be, like, why he's bringing it. Does that mean that you can tell a non-Jew to violate any biblical law for the sake of a mitzvah? I can see how people can reach that conclusion. So that could also answer your, you know, elevator question. like, oh, by, you know, him pushing this button for me, it enables me to, like, enjoy Shabbos better.
Right.
Like, if someone otherwise would be stuck in an elevator.
Right.
Now, keep in mind, I mean, that is a... one of my bosses asked some wonderfully, wonderful Jewish questions. He lived in Riverdale. And he asked me this question about having non-Jews, like, push the button for you, like, even a doorman without telling him explicitly. And he asked me, he's like, wait, isn't that cheating? You know, and this was before I knew, like, how to have, like, conversations with people without backgrounds. But anyway, I don't know how much people would apply this. I can see how people would extend this to anything. And then you could take a very broad approach to what's considered a mitzvah.
Right.
But at least the buying the house in Eretz Yisrael is mentioned explicitly in the Gemara, and that's why it's mentioned.
Okay.
Here also, it doesn't say, where, as it says before, the same applies in all situations.
Yeah, that's a good point. So, in terms of what's theoretically possible, you're going to find, again, opinions that can say almost anything at some point in the Jewish texts. Yeah, that's why, like, I'm also shying away from doing things that are definitive, because anytime I would see something definitive, someone is going to be able to find me a source that supports it, and you only need one source to disprove it. So I will just stand my ground saying, I'm sure you will find at least one sources that will go both ways on this. Which one is right? I don't know.
It's interesting here that it talks about that for a mitzvah you can do it during Shabbat. Mm. You can benefit from it if it's for a mitzvah.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas before we sort of talked about that you can't ask somebody to do something for you. You have to wait a certain amount of time until after. So in this example, buying a deed in Eretz Yisrael, it's not going to evaporate this option if you wait until after Shabbat.
Oh, it might. You obviously haven't done a lot in real estate.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's fair.
You think that's why? Because of urgency?
Sure.
Yeah, one day can make a big difference.
Well,
there's also
a
principle in Jewish law, mitzvah habali yaducha al tach mitzana. When you have the opportunity to do a mitzvah, you don't let it wait. You don't let it pass you by and say you'll get to it later, because opportunities pass. I mean, the thing above here, in number 10, right, you're talking about instructing a non-Jew, you know, to carry, I mean, he doesn't say about, like, carrying biblically or not, although technically those are, you know, rabbinic prohibitions, right, but shofar, you know, or whatchamacallit, bringing a knife for circumcision, right, you need to do the Brit Milah that day. So at least that's, you know, time sensitive. For other things, you might even be able to argue, if I don't do this now, it might not happen. I might just lose this opportunity. Real estate works fast, sometimes.
Can you do a Brit Milah on Shabbat?
If it's the eighth day. Meaning, if the kid was born on the previous Shabbat and you haven't pushed it off, meaning, like, that is the day it's supposed to be done, fine. Let's say the kid was jaundiced. And the first day that the kid, like, so you had to wait, like, say, a week after, you know, the Brit Milah. And the first day the kid is healthy is on Shabbat. You don't do it that Shabbat. You do it the Sunday. Meaning that's considered a nidcha when it's pushed off.
Do funerals take place on Shabbat?
No.
No, right? You wait?
Then you would actually have to wait until afterwards. Like for the burial and stuff. The only exception you have is Yom Tov Sheni in outside of Eretz Yisrael. Technically, you would do the funeral on that second day of Yom Tov. That's, like, really the only exception.
Okay.
All right?
Yes.
Cool. So I will see you all next week. And if y'all are around, this Wednesday we're starting the Kosher Kitchen Crash Course here. So hopefully we'll, you know, have a lot of stuff that'll make the kosher thing a lot more sensible.
Are those going to go online?